So this Sunday is often known by a number of different titles within the clergy. I'm going to tell you some secrets. One of which is, it's called Low Sunday. And the reason for that is that everybody is basically exhausted after Holy Week. So I am so very thankful and grateful that you have joined me here this morning, whether it's by Zoom or you're here in the sanctuary in person. The second thing that is often known by, not just by the clergy, but by others, is Doubting Thomas Sunday. Now, I think that Thomas gets a bad rap, and I'm going to tell you why shortly. But let's begin with some context. This particular pericope, and a pericope is basically a story, but it's a documented factual account. So I like using that term rather than story, because we've kind of ruined the term story into being something that's fictional. So this pericope begins on Easter evening and on into the night. Now, all Jerusalem must have been in turmoil. It must have been crazy in that city. First of all, you still have people from Passover who are there. Not to mention, you have the events of Friday, the crucifixions. In addition to the crucifixions, you have all these murmurings. And now on Sunday, and it's now Sunday evening, you have all the rumors that are flying everywhere. Jesus has risen from the dead. People are in a panic. People are overjoyed. People are confused. Kind of your typical day. But no, this wasn't a typical day. This is something that is at best confounding and at their worst a nightmare, at least for the chief priests. Now, I want you to remember that the crucifixion was, in fact, a very public event. This wasn't something done in secret, the way that some totalitarian governments do it today, where, you know, they just, well, we don't know where he went. We released him and he's nowhere to be found. No, this one was in public. He was on the top of a hill that could be seen from almost anywhere. And the people who attended, well, they were all sorts of people. Some who'd never seen a crucifixion before, and they were coming from the diaspora of the Jews, from countries all over the world. Some who, that was part of their entertainment, was to go to a crucifixion. But lots of people attended, including those who mocked him, including the chief priests, their guards, people from the temple. It was a crowded scene, and it did not happen in secret. And there could be no question as to whether or not Jesus died. The Romans were very effective and efficient when it came to execution. No one survived crucifixion. I'm not going to go into the gory details because I think we did that on Friday, but let us just say that no one survived. So the swoon theory that you hear from some of the heretics doesn't hold water. The swoon theory. nailed to a cross, the life just running out of you. And they want us to think that, oh, well, he just kind of lowered his head and took a little nap. And then when they took him down, he was revived. No. That's no. But then there are also people who believe that aliens came and formed us, so you never know. He did not swoon. Now I want you to go backwards just a bit to John 19. John 19, verse 31 is where I'm going to start. And it reads this way. Since it was the day of preparation, and so that bodies would not remain on the cross on the Sabbath, for that particular Sabbath was a high day because of Passover, the Jews asked Pilate that the legs of those executed might be broken and that they might be taken away. So the soldiers came and broke the legs of the first and then of the other who had been crucified with him. But when they came to Jesus, they saw that he was already dead, so they did not break his legs. But one of the soldiers pierced his side with a spear, and at once there came out blood and water. He who saw it has borne witness. His testimony is true. He knows that he is telling the truth, that you may also believe. John's saying, I was there. I saw it. I saw what happened. And many other people did too. Stayed to the end. Now, broken legs meant breaking the femur in a manner as to cause a compound fracture, which is a bleeding fracture. Now, so most of the time, the Roman executioners didn't even bother to see whether the person was dead or not. They just broke the legs. But I think because of the high profile of Jesus, and maybe the fact that the word had gotten around that Pilate believed Jesus was an innocent man, the guards at this time, the executioners, noticed that he was already dead. I have a sense that all of the people that were there, and as I mentioned, there were lots, most of them, their eyes were on Jesus. Remember the people who mocked him and said various things. One said, if you're the Messiah, come down off the cross. Everybody's going to pay attention to that. They want to see. There was a lot of attention. And so in this case, even though Jesus was already dead, one soldier decides, well, if we're not going to break his leg, then I'm going to jab a spear in him and we'll see. Well, with that spear, there at once came out blood and water. Now, they would have known back then even to ram the spear into either the spleen or the liver. And when one dies, that's where the blood tends to pool. So they were verified. They verified to themselves that he was dead. There is no question Jesus was dead, and they all saw him die. But I want you to take a quick look at Matthew 28. Matthew 27:62. It says this. The next day, that is, after the day of preparation, the chief priests and Pharisees gathered before Pilate. And they said, "Sir, we remember how that impostor said, while he was still alive, 'After 3 days I will rise.' Therefore, order the tomb to be made secure until the third day, lest his disciples go and steal him away and tell the people, 'He has risen from the dead,' and the last fraud will be worse than the first." Pilate said to them, "You have a guard of soldiers. Go, make it as secure as you can." So they went and they made the tomb secure, sealing the boulder, the stone, the rock, and setting a guard to watch over it. One little quick side road here that I find interesting. The chief priest said to Pilate, "This man said, 'After 3 days, I will rise.'" He didn't say that. He never said that. He said, "Destroy this temple, and in 3 days, I will rebuild it without hands." He didn't say he would rise. Where did the chief priest get this? Well, from the same place that I mentioned on Easter. They knew it was going to happen. They'd read the scriptures. They just didn't understand the power of God to make it happen. They thought that they could somehow stop it. "We'll put a guard there. We'll put a seal on the rock. No one would dare break it. Not going to happen." Bless you. Now, I'll tell you this. Does anybody really think that God needed to move the stone? No. The stone was not moved to let Jesus out. It was to let people in to see that he was gone. The angel said when they came in, "He's not here, he's risen." He'd already done that. They didn't need to move the stone except to let people in. Poor chief priests. I feel just a teeny incy wincy teeny piece of sorrow for them. You can't help but feel something for somebody who's so dumb, knows so much, and still refuses. Did you know that in this country, in the United States of America, there is an organization called the Flat Earth Society? There are over 300 members of the Flat Earth Society. Yes, that's what they believe. They still believe that the earth is flat. Some people, you can show them, you can tell them, you can point to it, but their presuppositions keep them from moving forward. In this case, they thought, "Well, maybe we could stop it." You know, here's the other interesting thing. Do you want to know why the vast number of conspiracies are proven to be untrue? And I mean the vast number. I read an article recently of a prosecutor who had studied conspiracies. He said, "You know, the problem is that conspiracies usually involve multiple people. And as soon as you have at least two, you have a problem." I like that. Because the more people that are involved, the more the nature of the conspiracy changes. And the more likely there's someone or more than someone who will eventually admit to the falsity of it. But most conspiracies get legs because people want to believe them as a function of their own presumptions. Why do people want to believe the swoon theory, the swoon conspiracy? Because they don't want to believe that someone actually died and came back to life, and that that someone is God. It does not fit into their analysis, in spite of the evidence that's there. So with all of that as context, let's dig in. First, I want you to note that in this morning's reading of the gospel, it says that Jesus came and stood among them. It was Easter evening, as I mentioned, and the disciples were absolutely frightened. It says so. It says so in the book. It says the house they were in was locked for fear of the Jews. Now, that only, I'm certain, was exacerbated by all the noise outside, by the torches that were going through the streets, by the talking and people arguing over did he or did he not. And the disciples, they don't really know what they're arguing about. They just know that things don't look good for them. Until Jesus enters a locked room with no commotion, no disruption to the structure of the room. He's just there. Now, take a guess. How do you think that they reacted when they're in this room and they're standing there and they're going, who's that? Who's that? How'd he get in? What's going on? And Jesus goes, peace be with you. Now that doesn't fit for them. That doesn't fit at all. You see, his resurrected body had the ability to take the form, the physical form, that defied all the laws of physics. You remember your list of laws of physics, right? You got all those right up there. The only one that's important to remember at this time is the second one, and that is that two solid objects cannot occupy the same space at the same time. That's why we have car crashes, because people want to test the second theory of physics. That's why they do it. They're just convinced that, no, I don't believe that. I'm going to show that it's wrong. They haven't done it yet, so no. How did Jesus get in? Because he is clearly, when they're looking at him, the nature of that body is a body. He's not, as we would say today, because of our technology with special effects, he's not a hologram. He's standing there. He's walking around, he's talking to them. What in the world? His resurrected body has the ability to flow in and out of different dimensions. He's just there. The interesting thing is, John doesn't tell us anything about when he leaves. Did he go up to the door and open it and go out? I don't think so. I think that the same way he came in is the way he went out. And he just wasn't there all of a sudden. And if that didn't get him talking, I don't know what would. His resurrected body, he was visually and physically the same. I think he was probably cleaned up a little bit, but basically he was the same. He retained the scars and the evidence of his wounds, yet they were clearly healed because they weren't having any effect on him. That didn't bother him that he had nail-scarred hands or that he had a wounded a wounded side. No, not at all. Second, I would also have you note that not only does Jesus come and stand among them, Jesus offers them peace, his peace. Now, as I mentioned, they're up in the room and they are anything but peaceful. They're agitated, they're afraid, they're anxious. They're trying to figure this out. They're talking and they're in this large, and by the way, it's more than the 12. We'll see that in a second, but it's more than the 12 that are in there. And they're going, so what do we do with this? And the women said, look, we told you, we saw him. He said this for us to tell you. Men being men, said, well, what are we going to do with this? Yeah, they're trying to figure it out. There got to be a plan, got to do something. And it's interesting because this state of being is just, you have a sense of what's going on there. You've been in places like that. Nobody quite knows what to do. Janet and I, we lived in Northern California during the Loma Prieta earthquake. In fact, the house that we lived in was 30 miles away. It was a jolting experience, trust me. And the one thing that everybody seemed to have in common is that nobody knew what to do. We all just kept running around, looking, seeing, well, okay, yeah. You know, all the bookshelves are on the floor. Okay, so yeah, and you're just walking around, not knowing. And I think that's what they were doing. They did not know what to do. So Jesus comes and he greets them in the typical way that you would greet someone in the first century in the Near East. Peace be with you. What a lovely greeting, isn't it? Isn't it really? I mean, we go, hey, y'all. Versus peace be with you. Maybe we need to start a trend. Probably not. But I want you to notice that he says it a second time. He doesn't leave it at that. He doesn't leave it as just a greeting. What does he do? He says, peace be with you, my peace be with you. What's he implying? He wants them to settle. Take a deep breath. What's going on around you doesn't matter. It doesn't matter at all. I want you to take that fear and anxiety and place it on me. James says, cast all your anxiety on him, for he cares for you. And that's what Jesus, he said, peace be with you. He does it a third time. And again, it's both a greeting and a reassurance that the first time was really him. Third, not only does Jesus come and stand among them, not only does Jesus offer his peace, Thomas serves an important role. You look and you say, well, how can somebody who doubts serve an important role? I'm glad you asked. Did you notice here that he wasn't there the first time? If you didn't notice it, John wanted to make it clear. Thomas wasn't there. Where was he? I don't know. I don't know whether he's the kind of person that has to go out and check things out and see how bad it is out there, and, you know, and come in and report. Maybe somebody said we're out of milk. Is there somebody who'll go down to the store? Thomas goes, well, yeah, I'll go. I need to buy a lottery ticket anyway. No, I don't know what he was doing, but he wasn't there. Did Jesus not know that Thomas was missing? Duh, no, of course he knew. I mean, Jesus is the second person of the Godhead. He is God. He is omniscient. He knows Thomas isn't there. He doesn't even have to say when he gets there, where's Thomas? You know, I went through all of this to come and see y'all, and he can't be here? What's going on? No, that's not it either. So did he do it to embarrass Thomas? No. No, I think this. He did it so that he could demonstrate to Thomas that he, Jesus, was in fact very much alive. Very much a physical being. And yet very much more than a physical being. If Thomas is there, that opportunity doesn't occur. Thomas plays a vital role in all of this. Thomas says, he's already said, if I don't see the scars on his hands and the scar on his side, if I can't touch them, I'm not going to believe. You guys, you're crazy. This has all gotten to you. Now, the interesting thing is, I don't think Thomas doubted the resurrection. I think Thomas doubted that the risen Christ shows up this way. I think he's thinking, well, yeah, okay, he rose from the dead, but he's certainly not coming back in that form. In giving Thomas the opportunity to actually make the proclamation, my Lord and my God, he places Thomas in a very vital role, because he tells his disciples, though they believe, they now have had physical evidence to support their belief. But he also knows that he's not going to be appearing and reappearing for the rest of historical time. He's not going to be looking at his calendar and going, oh, go back to Earth, make an appearance, CNN, Fox, ABC. No, he's not going back and forth. He sits at the right hand of the Father. For what reason? Because he serves as our mediator and our advocate in heaven. And he is going to depend on the basis of these disciples and subsequently apostles, that their testimony would be sufficient, would be based on their belief. So, what do we have? Well, we have that last phrase that he says to Thomas. Thomas, have you believed because you've seen me? Blessed are those who have not seen and who have yet come to believe. He says, you've had it easy. You guys have seen me. But those who will come behind, those that you will share, and those who come after you who will share, they will tell the world of God's salvation. And blessed are they who have not seen and yet who have come to believe. You pray about that. Amen.